God has really blessed me. You know, he let me work in DC, let me work with EIB in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley. And he's shown me through all those experiences that there is one problem and one solution, and that's why we do this show.
Welcome to A Disciple's View with Todd Herman.
When the God of the universe created the world, he didn't snap his fingers or wink his eye. The Lord spoke. He said, let there be light. Because we believe, we speak about the happenings in this world to remain mindful that our true home is with Jesus Christ and his kingdom. I'm Todd Herman. Welcome to A Disciple's View. Do you remember Patrice Cullors? Now, there's a reason I bring her up. It's not necessarily that she's in the news at the moment, but do you remember who she is? She's one of the founders of Black Lives Matter Incorporated, which is a domestic terror group and a huge brand. Patrice Cullors, as you might recall, purchased a home, I believe it was about $6 million, in Topanga Canyon, California. Topanga Canyon is, well, home to a lot of singers and actors, and it's a bit out of the way. It's not the Hollywood Hills. Back in the day, it's where bands like The Byrds lived and people like that. Neil Young had a home there at one point. So she did that as a professional socialist. I bring this up for a reason, because I bring up a headline from back in the day, May 2022, the Mail Online revealed. BLM founder Patrice Cullors paid her baby father $970,000 for creative services, her brother $840,000 for security, a fellow director $2.1 million, and reimbursed the organization $73,000 for a charter flight. Professional socialists, leftists, Marxists, is I think what they call themselves, professional Marxists, trained Marxists. Well, Marxists are well-trained. They keep what's best for them and everybody else, sacrifices for the people. Why would I bring this up on today's news day? AFR provides top-of-the-hour news live, and I get to hear it. You get to hear it. It's well done. It's balanced. And they're pointing out that, once again, we're having a discussion about our debt ceiling. We don't have one. And they're kind to point out at AFR that it's again a continuing resolution. And again, the news is so well done. That's exactly what it is. It's not a budget. It's a resolution. They don't do budgets anymore. What's so remarkable is that one of the sole things that Congress is required to do is create a budget. All the things they're not required to do, they somehow find time to do, but not the budget. Patrice Cullors, trained Marxist, using Black Lives Matter and corporate money to enrich herself and her friends. Washington, D.C. using ours. Are they that different? I mean, one is a domestic terror group, Black Lives Matter Incorporated. The other is not. It is a government. It's a fallen government, but it is a government. And if I think about this a little bit deeper, and I think about it a little bit more crisply in relation to the news, Joe Rogan, because of the footprint of his podcast, it's huge. Many, many, million people watch it. Millions of people watch it. Because of his footprint, there was a lot of attention paid to something Joe said. We can find billions of dollars for Ukraine when the residents of Maui get $700 and a goodbye. You remember the Maui fires? $700 one-time payment. Illegal immigrants coming into our country getting sometimes $10,000 in cash, $2,200 a month, $700 for the residents of Maui. There are a lot of people who think that fire, the result of it afterwards, was just a land grab. How am I combining these stories? At the beginning of the show, we say there's one problem and there's one solution. The problem is sin. The solution is to take the knee to God, to serve God. How does that happen in a nation where you have now a president, a figurehead, who's apparently getting visits from a Parkinson's doctor? This has become a story that's almost at this point a canard or something that we just hear about. Yes, 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 he's demented. Yes, he's got mental issues. Yes, it may be Parkinson's. It might be that and Alzheimer's combined. But I want to invite us to think about this in a slightly different way. Alex Berenson broke the story over the weekend that Dr. Kevin R. Kennard, a Parkinson's disease specialist, has visited the White House at least 9 times in the last year. This is from official White House logs. He's been visiting with the medical people in the residence, either Biden's personal physician or a nurse who coordinates care. Why would a doctor like this, specializing in Parkinson's, be going in and out of the White House so many times into the residential medical care facility? Perhaps it's because they think he has Parkinson's. Maybe he does. Shouldn't we know? We should. Shouldn't we know where our money to Ukraine is going? We should. It's trackable, but they choose not to track it. Shouldn't we have a little bit better handle on exactly who funded Black Lives Matter Incorporated? We should, but we don't. Why is that? Sin? Desire? Coveting? Taking what is not yours? Stealing? What's the solution? Well, for ourselves, how about if we be the people we want others to be? Yet change at home? We were talking about the Ten Commandments earlier being posted in our homes, not just in schools in Louisiana and elsewhere, but at home, or about on our hearts. There's this, though, the praying for people like Biden. I still don't do it well. I did not pray for Joe Biden once in the past 2 weeks, not once. I haven't prayed for Hunter Biden, and I haven't prayed for Jill Biden, not one single time. It never entered my mind. Does that give me spiritual dementia? Spiritual Alzheimer's? Or maybe it's just being human. Yeah, I think it's spiritual Alzheimer's. I'll tell you why. I talk about Biden every day. Every day. Part of my job is to talk about what he's doing or what the people who run him are doing. Spiritual Alzheimer's. I'm to pray for him, for our enemies. And I do consider the people who run him to be our enemies. I think that's self-evident. So maybe that change, that one problem, one solution, maybe that change is something that I need to do for myself. Maybe I'm being transformed by the things of this world. That happens. We're warned against it. Do not be transformed by the things of this world. But maybe I am being transformed into someone who can talk in 5 straight shows about Joe Biden, but only in this one remember, wait a minute, you haven't prayed for him. Or Jill, or Hunter, or Ashley, or Kamala Harris. I mean, you have all sorts of nicknames, the figurehead, Kamala Harris, but what about praying for Kamala and her soul? I wonder what would happen if in one day, every conservative Christian fell to their knees and begged for mercy for people like Biden and Kamala Harris. I wonder what God would do. I mean, if that happened, he'd already know what he was going to do. Blessed are the merciful, so they will receive mercy. Are we being merciful? It's hard. There's also a Biden aide. He talked to Ben Smith, a reporter of sorts, kind of sometimes more of a gossip columnist. He writes at semaphore.com. He said he received on July 1 a call from a government official with regular access to the West Wing who said they'd reached a breaking point and wanted to sound the alarm. They were careful on ground rules, no details on the specific policy area they'd worked on, no gender, age, or sexual orientation. Their credibility basically depends on my vouching they're a serious person, which I can do. Though I should also say this person has nothing to say about the president's physical condition and was limited to their own experience outside Biden's tight circle. Here is the assertion this person would like to get across. It's unclear to even some people inside the West Wing policy process which policy issues reach the president and how. Major decisions go into an opaque circle that includes White House Chief of Staff Jeff Zients, who talks to the president regularly, and return concluded. The big exception to this pattern, they say, is foreign policy. Pause. Foreign policy. A man who may well have Parkinson's, a man who's clearly mentally weak, and I don't say that to be pejorative, just descriptive, a man who forgets what he's saying, a man who forgets who his kids are, a man who forgets he has other grandkids, a man who literally this weekend it was revealed during a radio program where he was answering questions his campaign prepared, literally called himself a black woman. A black woman. He misspoke, but he always does. Foreign policy. What about war room policy? What about situation room policy? What about if, God forbid, there's a substantive attack on this country and Joe Biden is one of the people brought into that room and there is a debate? How do we respond? And we need to respond quickly. How do we respond? Ask yourself this question in that secure facility, somewhere deep below the White House, protected against blasts and bombs and explosions. There are 12 people. We've been attacked. What do we do? Who is going to trust the figurehead's assessment? What if he says fire? Do they do it? What if he says hold? Do they obey? What if he says, where am I? Why am I here? That's the stakes. And meanwhile, the corruption reigns. And meanwhile, I just lost myself again. Once again, I went through that entire scenario without a sense of mercy for that man. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. People continue to take the decision that the Supreme Court made on limited presidential immunity and turn this into the thing of panic. Jake Tapper still pretends that SCOTUS ruling on limited presidential immunities means presidents can murder Americans.
That was a stunning moment in April. Did the court just say, yeah, you can assassinate a political rival?
No, I don't think they did. That's a ridiculous answer by Donald Trump's team, a dangerous and reckless answer.
Obviously, there is a crisis of confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court, among many other institutions in America. And I want to just read from something from Justice Sotomayor's dissent on some of these issues that we're talking about. Let the president violate the law, she writes in her dissent. Let him exploit the trappings of his office for personal gain. Let him use his official power for evil ends. Because if he knew that he may one day face liability for breaking the law, he might not be as bold and fearless as we would like him to be. That is the majority's message today. Orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon? Immune. Immune, immune, immune.
Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. In carrying out official duties, the president does not have within his official duty the murdering of American citizens. Far from it, that requires due process. That's not an official duty. That's the thing of panic, but not a man who cannot speak a sentence where he doesn't say, I'm a black woman. A man who over the weekend was not just shown how to give money to the collection plate. He was handed the money. This was as he was pandering to a black church, a black pastor, apparently a pastor, perhaps an elder, to come to him or deacon and hand him a $100 bill and explain to him very, very patiently, no, sir, you take it over there. And Biden sits and questions this with a lost, confused face. Over there, what? Remember, he grew up in the black church. He tells us this all the time. So the SCOTUS ruling continues to be a thing of panic. Project 2025 from the Heritage Foundation is about what we're panic about, but not a lost and confused, mentally decrepit man in a room of 12 people after America's been attacked. As faces are turning to him, after all, he's supposedly president. What do we do, sir?
I shave the monkey.
What? I'm not trying to be funny. I'm not trying to be cruel. I'm trying to illustrate a point. Maybe we really should pray for mercy for Biden and the people who surround them. Maybe we really should pray for mercy for us. Maybe we should do more praying than talking about Biden. But then again, the Bible's full of what? Pornography? Now, I'll explain that when we come back. I'm Todd Herman. This is A Disciple's View. Appreciate you listening to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. The superintendent of what I call government schools in a good, well-run state that might still be public schools, Oklahoma. His name is Ryan Walters. He decided that they're going to teach the Bible and the Ten Commandments in school. And he said it's because they were foundational to Western civilization. It's always fascinating to read replies to statements like this in social media. Joshua Fontanella said, "Do you keep the Fourth Amendment?" I don't know what the Fourth Amendment would have to do with this, but that's an interesting question. There is the Republicans' goal is to establish a Christo-fascist dictatorship, and this person put up a great big meme to prove the point with a Nazi gold eagle at the center of the Nazi cross, the way that they polluted the cross of Christ. Well, certainly there's that. There's also this that people say, no, fact check. In fact, the Bible was not, in fact, foundational for Western civilization. As historians agree, Western culture began with the democracy in ancient Greece before the Bible existed. Foundational doesn't always mean at the very, very beginning. And what was Greece like? What was Rome like prior to it becoming a Christian nation? Does it bear more resemblance to the way our government was designed? I think it does, because, of course, it has become something of a dictatorship, which other people would like to see us return to. It's always instructive to read responses to this. Now, this is different from putting the Ten Commandments up on the wall by order. I don't stand with that decision. I'll tell you why. It's because I think it will not help. The Word of God never returns void. Don't get me wrong. I love the Ten Commandments. Not enough, but I do. But I noticed that Jesus never used force. Ever. I mean, one day, people will be forced to live with their decisions for eternity, but I can't think of a time where the Lord Jesus used force. I can't think of a time where he made people sit and listen. I can't think of an instance of that. So forcibly putting that into schools, I think, obviously invites lawsuits, but I also think it speaks incorrectly of the way we are to share the gospel. That is, through actions and words when we have good license to share those words with people. But teaching the Bible, of course. I'm a huge fan of comparative religion classes. I think that we should have comparative religion classes in this country. One of my favorite classes in high school was comparative religions. Only so long as it's done this way. Read the full texts. You can spend a quarter reading the Bible. Hard work, but it can get done. You could then read the, you could read Islam. You could read the Quran. It's hard to get through. It's sometimes nonsensical, but it can be done in a quarter and compare the two. I bring this up because on CNN, Casey Hunt had Ryan Walters on the program, and she asked him about this. In fact, this CNN host pretends the Bible has pornography in it as she questions Oklahoma State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Ryan Walters.
To not teach that in the classroom is academic malpractice. Our kids have to understand our history, and we're not going to hide that from them.
Will you allow teachers to teach all aspects of the Bible? How are teachers supposed to know what of the Bible to teach and what of the Bible not to teach? It's a simple question, given the fact that the Bible includes also pornographic material, something you've come out against and actually took a teaching certificate away from a teacher for giving access to students of pornographic material. That's in the Bible.
Yeah, let me be crystal clear. The Bible is not on the same plane as genderqueer and flamer.
And that's one way to put it. Another way to put it is this. What's the pornography in the Bible? Where is the description of a body part? Ever. A sexual body part. Ever. Where is the description of a sexual act in detail? There are disturbing scenes in the Bible. People going against God's will. There are suggestions of horrible, perverse scenes in the Bible, Sodom and Gomorrah. They are historical settings describing what was being done at the time to people and to people's bodies. But this response to Casey Hunt, do you honestly think that you could sit with someone and have a debate showing that the Bible is on the same grounds as the book that Ryan Walters mentions, or do you know that he has a limited time to make his case on your program? Do you honestly think that discussing what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah is the same thing as encouraging it to happen here with five-year-olds? How is that fair to other Christians? How is it fair to any Christian to make that statement? How is it caring? How is it caring to lie in that way? And if you honestly contend that the description of Sodom and Gomorrah is pornography, then you're talking about pornography without images or mentions of body parts? That's not what Ryan Walters was against. He was against the display of body parts, the glorification of sex acts for young people, the pushing of them, despite all physical evidence showing that this is sometimes very injurious and harmful and certainly not fruitful from a family perspective, nor are kids' minds ready for this. I would encourage us to have classes in comparative religions again, because we can take that description, the Bible, and put it side by side with the Quran. We can do a comparison as to which has led to greater fruits. To me, that's the way in schools to teach faith. I mentioned my comparative religion classes. I was so gifted to have had the presence of the greatest teacher I've ever had in my life. He happened to have been a Jesuit-trained teacher. He went to Jesuit schools. He was an academic. He was probably the, I guess, most educated of all of our teachers in my high school. And he taught our comparative religions class, as well as social studies and some other classes. When I walked into his comparative religions class, he showed God's face without ever speaking a word of the gospel to me. This was how it was done. His name was John Traynor. I used to call him the Monsignor. That is, after I got to know him. Want to know how he introduced himself to me? When I walked into the class that day, it was the first time I'd been in John Traynor's class. I knew of him by reputation. I respected him by reputation, and I didn't always respect teachers. But he wasn't in class. John was not there. Dr. Traynor was not there. Now, me being who I was, as sort of a spoof, a joke, after Mr. Traynor wasn't there for about 5 minutes, I went to the blackboard. I got up from my seat, went up to the blackboard, wrote my name, Mr. Herman. Everybody there knew me. I was well known in school. And I began to teach. And as I was teaching, people listened. We started to have a discussion about events of the day. And in walked John Traynor. He had always a sport coat, always elbow patches, always fashionable shoes, always an open collar, respectfully buttoned to the second to last button, always dressed well. He had gray hair, balding, and he had piercing turquoise eyes. He stood in the doorway. Other teachers would have said, sit down. What are you doing? Sit down. Shut up. Mr. Traynor walked in. I said, oh, Mr. Traynor's here. I'll sit down. And he said, no. Please continue. I was late. That's my fault. I appreciate you taking the initiative, Todd. Where's your seat? I said, well, I was sitting right here. I'll sit here. Please continue. You have another 15 minutes, and then I'll take over. So I continued on the same vein, the same discussion we were having about daily issues in the town of Spokane. After 15 minutes went by, I wrapped this up, and I said, now I welcome our actual teacher, Mr. John Traynor. At that moment, there was a relationship born. He noticed something about me. I like to speak in front of people. I noticed something about him. He was gentle. He was respectful. He had a smirk when he stood back up. A smirk. A friendly smirk. I took my seat. And John Traynor said, Todd, here's the deal. The next time class begins for the rest of the year, you will begin class. You will begin each day with a statement of what's your beef, but it must be related to current events or to the topics that we're covering in comparative religions. Agreed? Yes. And so it was. See, he was showing me the gospel and I didn't know it. He'd identified something that God gave me in the way of a gift, and he decided to help me steward it. I'm thinking again of teaching the Bible in the classrooms. He taught the Bible. He taught the Quran. I knew he was a Jesuit. We all did. I never heard him criticize the Quran. I heard him question it. Why do you think, he would say, there was this narrative change? Muhammad had been speaking of peace. He'd been speaking of getting along, but now at the point of this book, he seems to be speaking of war, smashing babies against rocks. Why do you think there was this change, he would ask in the point of discussion. Those of us who knew anything about Muslim history, which is very few of us, would say, hadn't he gained power? Yes. Yes. And he would say, how does this compare to the narrative of the Bible? He would ask. In the Old Testament, many of you were very disturbed by the stories of violence. You were relieved during the New Testament. How does this compare? I remember a student raising his hand and saying, it's in reverse. When Muhammad gained power, he became violent. When Christians gained influence, when Jesus became famous, when he became notable, when he had an army, he became more peaceful. Not that he was ever violent, but he showed even more peace. He didn't have the word humility in his mind, but that's what he showed. Side-by-side comparison of these two works in discussion with a Jesuit who could have laid it all to rest in a sermon, explained it to us, but he wouldn't. It was always discussion. He was showing us the gospel. He was showing us the face of God, never having to speak a word of the gospel. He was showing God's face. Never more so than on two occasions. One, in a different course of his, in a sociology course, I signed up for every one of his courses when I found out how great his teacher was. I was in another course of his, and we were talking about social groups. Unique set-aside social groups. And this boy sitting in front of me, this boy who had a very weird thing about him, very strange, awkward kid, he raised his hand and he said, what about the blacks? There was a black girl sitting in front of me. I had a huge crush on her. Her name was Rochelle. Lovely, lovely girl. And, well, actually, she was sitting, she was sitting behind me. Rick was sitting in front of me. I pushed Rick. I pushed him in the back for saying that. Mr. Trainer said, no, Todd, please. Rick. Oh, no, Rick had said colored. That's right. He said the coloreds. John Trainer said, Rick, what color? And Rick said, what? He goes, you said coloreds. What color? Oh, black. He said, Rochelle will correct us, but I believe, Rochelle, black people prefer to be called black rather than colored. Is that correct? Rochelle said, yes, Mr. Trainer. Rick turned around and said, I'm sorry. He didn't know. Mr. Trainer, in a very gentle way, again, showed the face of God. He corrected, truth wrapped in grace. He was participatory. And later in a class, he referenced that exact moment in going back and teaching the Bible. Is racism biblical? Is it Quranic? He asked. We had a discussion about it. Is it biblical? Those of us who'd read the work in his class called back to neither servant nor slave, neither Greek nor Jew. Multiple people brought that up. In the case of the Quran, we talked about the anti-Jewish rhetoric of Muhammad side by side. Mr. Trainer had been inspired by that moment. He didn't use Rick's name. He didn't think Rick was a racist. I no longer think Rick was a racist. I think he was an awkward kid. But that comparison was right there on the tip of the tongues of students who'd been exposed in an academic sense to the Bible, not in a preaching sense. If John Trainer had been a cold man, if he had been an authoritarian man, he wouldn't have been communicating the gospel, even as he never said, I'm a Christian. Some of us knew. but he never had to say it. Well, and then there was this moment. That same kid, Rick, that same awkward kid, Mr. Trainer put him on my team. We were to do a bit of research in the library and then write a quick paper, all of us together, teamwork. And I assigned people roles. I was the leader of the group. That was just the way things happen. I was the leader of the group, and I said to Rick, you get to sit here and guard the table. Everyone else had jobs to do around the library, research, getting books, getting us ready to write. But Rick was to guard the table because I thought he was stupid. God forgive me. I was walking away from the table, and Mr. Trainer pointed to me and very quietly said, just pointed, no sound, come here. I went over and I leaned down and he said, Todd, do you think at some point that boy Rick will have suffered enough pain in his life? I was instantly shamed, instantly judged internally, not by him. I said, you're right. And I went back and got Rick and said, you're with me, bud. He had shown me the face of God, never having said he was a Christian. I had the honor of my life of praying for that man weeks before he died, visiting him at his home. That friendship he created when he walked into the doorway and said, what's your beef? It lasted 20 years. Such a godly man. That's the way to do it. We'll come back with the Tower of Babbling under Disciples View. Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. You know, Randy and I were just talking during the break, and he asked me, where am I at in terms of them being able to replace figurehead Biden? Them being the people who run him, the DNC, etc. And what I said, I'll just tell you, is I'm not really willing to take bets on this one. Here's why. It's because there's no honor among thieves. They may decide to replace him. They may not. It would violate DNC rules. They don't care about DNC rules. They are as duplicitous a group of people as ever existed. They might well think that, look, we're going to cheat anyway, and we're not really counting on voters. We're counting on drop boxes, and we're counting on fraud, and we're counting on different papers, and we're counting on different printers. We're counting on ballot harvesting. We're counting on code that we might be able to manipulate. We're not going to leave this to chance anymore. We got away with it last time. I know the election was rigged. There's no doubt. No one can really argue that it wasn't rigged. There are people saying it's not stolen. Many people saying it's not stolen. I don't know how you can say it was rigged and not stolen. That seems like walking a fine line to me. And yet the reason I'd say rigged is because all the rules rigged it. And we know what the rules are, were, etc. So do I think they can get Biden to step aside? No, they can't get him to unless they have something on him. And they have everything on him. They've got the family business dealings. They've got the sexual things. They've got Ashley's diary. They could turn this all on him. They won't, because then it would put back to light their institutions, the institutions they've captured, because they want to be able to pretend these institutions are trustworthy in going after Donald Trump. So again, could they force him out? I mean, they could kind of blackmail him out, but they have all that material and they're not using it now. Or maybe he's resisting. Can they convince him to leave? No. I mean, they could convince him in 5 minutes. He could say, okay, I'll leave. And the next 5 minutes, he could forget he had the conversation. I never agreed to that. They couldn't control him once he left, unless they took him out. And I don't think they're going to do that. I mean, they would, but why? Because he could quit. I've decided to step aside, and he could leave public life and later say, I never decided to step aside. They pushed me out. And it could create that crisis. They might well think, look, just let him win this thing and then we'll deal with it. Lee can't have Kami Harris, and that's the other part of this. Kami Harris is one of the least popular politicians in the country. She's unpopular with her own staff. She had black staff members leaving, black women leaving. Why? Well, because apparently she's an abusive person and she's not black. She was Indian American her whole life until she decided, hey, I'd be better off black in politics. So they've got Kami Harris to think about. They can't move her out because she's a DEI hire. She's there because she's a black woman, except she's not black. so she gets to play black on TV and stay in that role. They know they can't bring in a white man over the top of a black woman, even though she's not black, so Gavin Newsom. I mean, he'd be the natural choice running this shadow presidency, campaign for president. So as I told Randy, I'm not willing to take a bet on this because there's no honor among thieves. Now, these discussions are certainly going on. The figurehead Biden wrote a letter back to congressional leaders and said, I decline to step aside. And there's Hill Democrats who are torn about this. They should be torn about it. But can they force him to do anything? No. Is there anything, though, that the Democrats won't do? No. Pause and think about this. Is there anything the Democrats won't do? I can't think of anything. And for that reason, I'm not willing to take bets on this. It's absolutely going to be interesting, as Randy and I agreed. It's already interesting, and it's already proving to be catastrophic for the believability of the group of people whose whole lives are about being believed, and that is the Mockingbird Media. This will prove to be one of the last and final death knells into the Mockingbird Media, because you watch this. No matter what happens, they will find a way to back the play of the party. Because at all costs, Trump must be prevented from going back into office, even though he governed as a moderate, largely. That we've recognized. Here's one of the things they know. They have radicalized Donald Trump. They have radicalized that man. Think of this. When he went into office, he made certain promises, many of them to his great credit, he kept bringing business back, lowering the tax rates to bring business back, making it more costly to do business here rather than to pretend to have your company located across the ocean in Europe. He carried through on that. He was building the wall. He did right-size NATO commitments. He did not start World War III. In fact, he confronted dictators. He got concessions. They got the peace deal, so-called, in the Middle East. They got all that. He governed as a moderate. And then, in my judgment, and absolutely President Trump's judgment, they stole the election from him. And then they paraded him around courtrooms. And then they tried to take his entire fortune from him. All his money, all his businesses. They tried to ban him from ever doing business in New York. They're still trying to do that. They're trying to put him in prison for things that are common for politicians in this country to do, common for a lot of people to do. Hush money is not an uncommon thing. They've radicalized him. And he has every reason to be radicalized. So they've got to keep him out. So are they able to get Biden out of the way? I don't know. I'm not willing to take a bet on that. But here's what I do know. God doesn't care. Oh, he cares. It's his world. Biden has that figurehead role because God has allowed it. What God cares about is, are we really this spun up about who's leading this country? Are we really, really saying, but who will be king? I don't want a king. I have one. On that, I'm going to place a bet. God wins. I am honored to stand on that side, on the only side that actually wins. That part I'll take a bet on. On this program, we thank the Lord for placing supposedly wise people on tall towers of shaking sand with their feature called the Tower of Babbling.
You know about the biblical truth of the Tower of Babel. A Disciple's View presents...
Who doesn't love a yellow school bus?
Trans women are women, trans men are men, and non-binary people are non-binary.
If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money.
The Tower of Babbling.
Three sound bites in today's Tower Babbling, almost always three sound bites. Democrat operative George Stephanopoulos tried to help figurehead Biden recover from the terrible incident where people got to see how utterly demented he has become.
Let's start with the debate. You and your team have said you had a bad night. But your friend Nancy Pelosi actually framed the question that I think is on the minds of millions of Americans. Was this a bad episode or the sign of a more serious condition?
It was a bad episode. No indication of any serious condition. I was exhausted. I didn't listen to my instincts in terms of preparing. And it was a bad night.
No indications of any serious condition. Sounds like something he's been caused to memorize. Sounds like a note from a doctor. In point of fact, while George Stephanopoulos, I'm sure, tried to help, he is a Democrat operative. In point of fact, to George Stephanopoulos, and in fact to a concession to him, he asked follow-up questions. And if you watch the interview, it made Biden very, very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. In fact, he looked angry that Stephanopoulos dared to follow up. Next soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. Figurehead Biden doesn't know if he watched the debates.
Did you ever watch the debate afterwards?
I don't think I did, no.
Well, what I want to get at is, what were you experiencing as you were going through the debate? Did you know how badly it was going?
Yeah, look. The whole way I prepared, nobody's fault, mine. Nobody's fault but mine. I prepared what I usually would do, sitting down, as I did come back with foreign leaders or the National Security Council, for explicit detail. And I realized about partway through that, you know, all the, I get quoted, the New York Times had me down at 10 points before the debate, 9 now or whatever the hell it is. The fact of the matter is that what I looked at is that he also lied 28 times. I mean, the way the debate ran, not my fault, nobody else's fault. No one else's fault.
But it seemed like you were having trouble from the first question in, even before he spoke.
Well, I just had a bad night.
So as Stephanopoulos is pressing him, and again, to George's credit, he actually did follow up. Lost in that was, did you ever watch the debate afterwards? Biden, I don't think I did. You don't recall. Again, I present the scenario we talked about in the first segment, the Situation Room. God forbid the United States has been attacked. There's 12, maybe 15 people locked down in a secure facility far below the White House. Mr. President, should we fire the missiles? What are we talking about? Wait, what happened? That's something we cannot afford. Will they get him out of the way? I don't know. Because the Democrats are willing to do anything to hold on to power, quite obviously. Last soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. So-called doctor Debbie Birx wants to recreate the COVID PCR test fraud with cows.
We're not testing to really see how many people have been exposed and got asymptomatically infected. We should be testing every cow weekly. You can do pooled PCR. We have the technology. The great thing about America is we're incredibly innovative.
Innovative. Well, let's begin with this. Asymptomatic transmission doesn't happen in bird flu. It didn't happen with COVID. Asymptomatic transmission has never been a factor in the communicable disease of upper respiratory viruses. Never. Number two, the PCR tests, as the founder, again, the creator, the inventor, Kerry Mullis said, are not designed to find viruses. In fact, it will find anything in your body if you turn it up high enough. It's the same swindle with the same goal. Modified RNA injections in cattle, the same way they attempted to push them into all of us, and a whole bunch of us said, not in your lives, we're not doing it. They're going to prepare the same swindle again. And Biden is the perfect chief executive for this. Because, again, his mind is so weak. Will they take him out? Don't know. Because the Democrats are willing to do anything. There is no honor among thieves. And that's a wrap for today's Tower Babbling.
That was the Tower of Babbling.
I don't have anything to share with all of you at this time. And I'll just leave it there.
On a Disciple's View.
I shared with you earlier the discussion of this class that my beloved teacher, whom I referred to as the Monsignor, taught. Well, a couple of them. One of them was the comparative religions classes. And I talked about this 20-year friendship that began. When John Traynor, that teacher, was found to have had a brain tumor, and the way it happened was so, so dramatic. John was giving a speech at Gonzaga University. He had been made the headmaster of Gonzaga Prep. He was the only layperson to ever be headmaster of that school, which is a Catholic high school and a good one. He was the only layperson to have that job. He was giving a speech at Gonzaga University when suddenly this great and eloquent man began speaking gibberish and then couldn't speak at all and had to be taken off stage. I learned that he had a brain tumor the size of a grapefruit in his mind, in his brain. I was living in Seattle at the time, so I sent him a note. And the note said, "I want to tell you, you are not yet allowed to die. I have a child that's not met you. The child's on the way. My wife is pregnant. She must experience a trainerism. She must get to meet the Monsignor. Here are the stories I will share about you in prior to her meeting you." I shared with him his great wisdom and how it had gotten me through the hardest times in my life, even at that stage. And I shared with him the number of people who called me to say, "Did you hear about Mr. Trainer?" And I shared with him the great victory that would ensue when he came back and what it would show of God's might and power. I can't tell you how those words poured out of me. I know they weren't mine. I know they were inspired. And wouldn't you know it, 3 weeks, 4 weeks go by, and then 6 weeks, and then one night the phone rang, and I picked it up. The old days of the home phones, and there was John Trainer. There's John Trainer. "Todd, your letter made a difference. The Lord has rescued me. I look forward to meeting your daughter." And then he said this to me. He said, "You were such a challenge to your mom. I'm praying that your daughter is a challenge to you." Well, Mr. Trainer, Monsignor, we certainly did have challenging times. And I can see that smirk on your face because God took us through it just as he did you. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. Until we speak again together, may the peace of the Lord that surpasses all understanding reign over you, wash over you. On behalf of Randy and AFR, I'm Todd Herman. This has been A Disciple's View.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.